Hello, and welcome to the STLE Compass, brought to you by the Society of Tribologists and Lubrication Engineers. The STLE Compass is your convenient and reliable resource for the latest developments in the tribology community. I'm Kara Lamar, Education Manager at STLE, and in today's episode, we'll take a look at space tribology, starting off with a review of general aspects of the field and moving into current research and work that's being done to eliminate friction, wear, and other tribological issues. And today we'll talk to Dr. Chris Delacorte about this topic. Chris is a senior research tribologist at NASA's Glenn Research Center in Cleveland, Ohio. There he's been doing some tribology research related to space and aeronautic systems since 1985. Over his career, he's had the opportunity to work on a variety of interesting tribological challenges, including the space shuttle main engine turbopump bearings, high-temperature solid lubricants and foil air bearings for oil-free turbochargers, aircraft turbines, and space power plants. In 2008, he worked on the team that determined the root cause for the failure of the large rotating joint, aka the SARJ, used to point the solar panels on the International Space Station. More recently, he's been addressing other tribological problems on the space station and Mars Science Laboratory, aka MSL, or the Curiosity rover. In his spare time, he is developing the next generation ball bearing materials using hard but super elastic nickel titanium alloys. Chris is an active STLE fellow, and he's the founding editor for TLT and currently serves on the STLE's board of directors. So, Chris, welcome to the STLE Compass.
Thanks.
We're glad to have you. So what I want to do is start off and just get some definitions from you. So what's the difference between a liquid and a solid lubricant?
Well, that's really a good question, Kara. It's actually probably a better question to ask, what are the similarities between a liquid and a solid lubricant? I mean, the obvious thing is a liquid lubricant is a lubricant that's liquid, and a solid lubricant is a lubricant that's solid. But I think it's easier to define first, what is the role of a lubricant? In the most basic terms, the role of a lubricant is to reduce friction and wear, right? But when we talk about lubricants, we in the tribology world really like to talk about shear forces. That is, when you rub two bodies together, how hard is it to slide or roll one surface over another? And one of our former colleagues, the late Maurice Godet, had a really good way of explaining what lubricants are. And when you understand that, you can understand the difference between solids and liquids. But Maurice explained that, you know, whenever you have two bodies that contact one another, there's always something else in between the two bodies, a so-called third body. Whenever two surfaces interact, there's that interfacial region, which really controls friction. And he liked to talk about the third body being the shear layer. And if it's soft, then it provides a lubricating function. So in respect, if you had two surfaces rubbing on one another and you put a liquid in between, that liquid, if it had a low resistance to shear or slide, then it acts as a liquid lubricant. Conversely, if you have two bodies contacting one another and there's a third body made out of a solid material in between that happens to be easy to shear or easy to smear or slide, then it's a solid lubricant. And in effect, they both reduce shear forces. So, you know, to summarize briefly, you know, a solid and a liquid lubricant are kind of the same thing. They're both third bodies that you put in between two other bodies that come into contact. And you want that third body or that lubricant to be easy to shear.
Okay. So what are some typical examples of a solid lubricant then?
Well, there's the obvious solid lubricants, things that we're all very familiar with, the soft polymers like Teflon. Then there's the inorganic materials like graphite and molybdenum disulfide. Those are the ones we're all kind of familiar with. And again, they provide that role of being a easy to shear layer that separates two otherwise contacting bodies. But there's also more subtle solid lubricants like soft metals, such as lead, gold, and silver, that we don't think of as lubricants all that often, but we use them as such. And then there's the more exotic ones, like the boric acids and things of that nature, and fluoride coatings. Some of the coatings behave as solid lubricants for different reasons. The fluoride coatings are soft materials that have high temperature capability, and the boric acids are layered structure materials like graphite that, when you mix them with water, they form like a deck of playing cards that sit between two surfaces in contact and are easy to slide over one another. And when you make a solid lubricant, it's also kind of important to keep in mind that most of the commercial saw lubricants are really combinations. They're combinations of binders, which you might think of as a glue, mixed with saw lubricants to form, you know, a coating that provides a wear-resistant sort of a matrix with the soft saw lubricants as a reservoir.
Okay, so what are the advantages and limitations for each?
Well, in a general sense, the liquid lubricants have an advantage because they can easily be replenished and offer a longer service life. Of course, the limitations for a liquid lubricant is that it has to be sealed inside whatever you're trying to lubricate, whether it's a bearing or a transmission or a mechanism or an engine. The solid lubricants are simpler. They work better than liquid lubricants at extremely low and extremely high temperatures, but they're not as easy to replenish, and they kind of have a limited life. You sort of put a coating on a component and put it into service, and when the coating is worn out, you know, your friction and wear go up. And then, of course, you've got things like greases, which are really a hybrid. A grease is sort of like a sponge made out of soap fibers at the macroscopic level, that are infused with oils and sometimes infused with solid lubricants as well. And greases kind of combine the best of both worlds. You've got your liquid and solid lubricants there held in a matrix, so they don't have to be sealed quite as well as a lubricant. So it's sort of different courses or different horses for different courses, as they say.
Okay, and you mentioned that solid lubricants have kind of a limited life. What happens when it does run out? Do you just recoat it?
Well, you can recoat it if you have the luxury of getting into your machine and doing a relube job. Unfortunately, most of the time that you use a solid lubricant, it's a component that you don't have a chance to ever touch it again, at least not without going to great expense. I mean, take a fairly straightforward case, you know, such as the window mechanism of a car. You know, you might put a solid lubricant coating on some of the components in there and build the car around the mechanism and never touch it again. So generally speaking, solid lubricants are not designed to be replenished.
And then, so what are the best applications for each liquid and solid lubricants?
Well, I don't know if you can ever say best applications, but I've been giving this a lot of thought over the last 5 or 10 years, especially because I get asked a lot what kind of, you know, lubricant is best for a particular application. And my philosophy is kind of as follows. If you've got some kind of a machine or mechanism that has to provide some kind of motion, if you can design your mechanism so that you can get motion through the flexing of a spring, that's actually preferable to the second way of getting motion, which is rolling contact. And then the reason I talk about that flexing thing is I work for NASA, and we oftentimes design pointing mechanisms for space telescopes. And some of those mechanisms only have to move a few degrees one way or another. And we often do that just by bending of a beam. And I always think if you can avoid a rubbing or rolling contact, that's better than having to have something that needs to be lubricated. So I always tell people flexing is better than rolling, and rolling contact is better than sliding. And if you've got to have a mechanism that has sliding contact, greases and liquid lubricants are better in terms of performance than solid lubricants. And if you're going to have to use solid lubricants, then the conventional solid lubes, like I mentioned before, the graphites and the Teflons and what have you, are typically better performers than those exotic materials I talked about. And the thing to bear in mind is that specific applications often preclude the preferred approach or the preferred material. In other words, you may have an application that if you have a liquid present and it vaporizes it at ultra high vacuum like we have in space, or the lubricant can't take the temperatures, then you can't use oils and you have to use solid lubricants. But just so that everyone, you know, keeps in mind that all moving surfaces in contact, even rolling contact, need lubrication. There's no such thing as a pure rolling contact at the microscopic level. Even materials that roll over one another, there are some atoms in that rolling contact that are sliding. And just like Maurice Godet pointed out to us, when you've got atoms that are rubbing against one another, you're going to wind up having a third body there. And if it's not intentionally a lubricant that's there, it's going to be a wear debris particle that forms when two surfaces rub. So look, as far as lubricants are concerned, solid lubricants are good, liquid lubricants are good, but it's different lubricant approaches for different applications.
Last time we heard from you in TLT, you were revealing a new material for bearings, nitinol. So what's happened since then? Any new developments in that arena?
Oh, sure. We've been making lots of progress. I've been working in the field for a while, and it's really rare for something new to come along. And a few years back, working with some colleagues in industry, they brought me what I thought was a new technology. It's a bearing material based upon nickel and titanium. Which is affectionately termed nitinol. And some just give you some background on nitinol. It's an old Navy technology that was put forward, and that's where the name came from. It's nickel titanium naval ordnance lab, because a guy named Bueller at the Naval Ordnance Lab came up with it back in the 1950s. And it's an interesting alloy because it's at the same time it's hard. And it's non-magnetic, and it has no iron in it, so it doesn't rust. And the idea had been abandoned decades ago to use it because it was just so hard to work with. But applying modern processes that have developed over the years for ceramic materials, we actually wind up being able to make this into things like bearings. It's an interesting alloy because it's a corrosion-proof material that's also a member of the superelastic family. That includes the well-known shape memory alloy, nitinol 55. We just add a little extra nickel to the nitinol 55, and it eliminates that shape memory effect. But the material retains its super elastic properties, meaning it's kind of like a hard rubber. And we've done some research to indicate that we can make bearings that are not only corrosion immune, but highly resistant to shock load damage. It's kind of the holy grail for spaceflight hardware. This stuff is interesting also because, unlike some of the emerging ceramic hybrid materials, the nitinol 60 is electrically conductive. And the really interesting thing and exciting thing from me, from the perspective of a researcher, is that we've only been working with this 60 nickel titanium, which is 60 weight percent nickel and 40 weight percent titanium. It has no other additives in it. And we've just started formulating new versions of it that have a little pinch of this and a little dash of that. And we're able to refine its properties and enhance them even further. So I'm really looking forward to, further developments with these alloys, as time goes on.
So has it been commercialized yet, or where might it be used?
Well, the nitinol 60 is in the process of being commercialized. We've got some patent applications into Washington, and we're working with industry right now to make our first complete bearings, and we're conducting lots of the supporting tests that will guide us in how to use it, things like fracture strength and rolling contact fatigue resistance and all that kind of thing. Right now, everything is looking really good. We expect the initial nitinol 60 bearings to be used to fix an ongoing challenge on the International Space Station's wastewater treatment system. As you can well imagine, in order to turn the wastewater on the station into water that we can drink again, there's all kinds of chemical processes involved, and one of them means taking the wastewater and making it highly corrosive, and then heating it up and boiling it inside of a vacuum chamber. And the vacuum chamber up on the space station has to rotate at the same time, and the bearings that are in that system are really suffering. The first bearings were made out of stainless steel, and they corroded like crazy. The second set of bearings are made out of a corrosion-proof soft cobalt alloy, and they're wearing out. So we're hoping that this nitinol 60 will solve the corrosion problem and the wear problem all in one fell swoop. So we're kind of looking for niche applications in which the unique capabilities of this material are going to solve problems. And whatever we learn there, we expect to kind of transfer into industry.
Well, sure. Once you find out it's successful, well, then you can take it and apply it to other things.
Exactly.
So what are you working on now?
Well, in addition to kind of pushing the superelastic bearings into use, we're working on some tribology challenges inside Stirling engines, which are little piston engines that convert heat from any source, including a nuclear power, into electricity. And they've got tight clearances and gas bearings and coatings and things of that nature inside. And we're working on some life test issues that have come up. Those are for unmanned space missions. And really, I've spent quite a bit of time working over the past couple of years just to increase the general recognition, even within my own agency, even within NASA, that the best way to fix a space tribology problem is to avoid them through good upfront design practices. And I think that that's probably the truth, the same thing is true for all of the engineering disciplines. Just to give you an example, we're hosting a class here for NASA colleagues in about a week and a half to give them training on the latest ball bearing design and analysis tools. Hopefully, we're going to be engineering new machinery for the space program that makes sure that we don't overload ball bearings, right from the get-go.
Certainly. Design is really important, and that's what I've heard from a lot of people, is that starting with a good product is a lot easier than going back and trying to fix it with lubricants or what have you.
Yeah, exactly. What I try to tell people is that our companies that make bearings and companies that make seals and, to a certain extent, companies that make gears, they know how to make these precision components, and when properly applied, they don't fail. And so if you've got a new machine and your bearing keeps failing, the chances are the problem is not in the bearing, but in the machine design itself. So we're trying to train people on how to be able to understand what mechanical components can do for us and what lubricants can do for us, and don't try to push them beyond what we already know the limits are.
And so we kind of talked about this a little bit, but what's the impact of your research, or what are some of the applications?
I think that's a good question, and I think it's hard to really know whether what you've done is making a difference, especially in the aerospace field where it takes so long for technology to make it from the lab into the marketplace. But looking back now, I can see that some of my early solid lubricant technologies are making headway in industrial applications. So we did work early on in high temperature solid lubricants that are now used in furnaces as bushings for conveyor systems. And we know we've got power plants all over the world that are using some of the early coatings that we developed here for valves, for steam turbine control valves, and those kind of applications reduce downtime and reduce costs and ultimately improve productivity. We worked for many years on oil-free turbines that are using foil gas bearings and high-temperature solid lubricants for start-stop, and those are now commercially available in size classes from 15 to 250 kilowatts of electrical power and getting bigger. And just recently, we're hearing that that some of our work on oil-free turbochargers is emerging for cars and trucks and fuel cell blowers and wastewater treatment blowers and lots of high-efficiency industrial machines, sort of obsoleting conventional machinery all around the world. So it's kind of encouraging to see, the progression where, you know, we do research and we write research papers and we go to conferences and present our work. And it's nice to see people that are actually following up and learning from what we've published and making new products and ultimately moving technology forward.
Definitely something tangible from all the work that you've put in and the hard work behind it. It's got to be rewarding, I bet.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. Okay, so talking a little bit more about another project of yours, Sarge, have you heard anything or anything more about that re-lubrication project?
Well, it's kind of interesting that you bring that up. Listeners may have caught a short article I wrote a couple years ago about the world's most extreme lube job. As some of you know, the space station on orbit has some pretty unique mechanisms, and one of the mechanisms we affectionately call the Sarge, S-A-R-G. It stands for Solar Alpha Array Rotary Joint. It's a big bearing that allows the space station solar cells to rotate and stay pointed to the sun while the space station orbits the globe. And we had a failure on one of those bearings shortly after launch, and I was lucky enough to be on the team to try to figure out why it failed. And it turned out it failed because the solid lubricant that was used wasn't really up to the task. So the astronauts went out on the wing and literally wiped off the wear debris and replaced some of the bearings and added some good vacuum grease. And it's been running up there happily since we re-greased it in 2009. And just a few months ago, we sent our astronauts back out there to do an inspection, and everything looked great. We had them add a little extra grease just for good measure, but we think we're going to be okay for a long time now. And we haven't sort of put it to bed yet completely. We've got some ground tests that are ongoing that we're trying to sort of accelerate the depletion of the grease, so that we'll have an idea of how long the grease job is going to last before we need to send astronauts out on the wing again.
Okay, so planning ahead, that's good.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay. So recently, there's obviously the shuttle program is coming to an end, but that's not the end of the space program, obviously. So how will things change going forward with that particular program ending?
Well, you know, the shuttle really did its job and did its job well. And the primary purpose of the space shuttle was to be able to launch large payloads up to the space station to construct the space station. And the space shuttle was also designed to be able to have astronauts spend more time in space doing experiments and also to service satellites like the Hubble Space Telescope. But now that the space station is fully operational, the need for the shuttle had been diminished. And so the idea was to bring it to an end and have other ways of getting up to the space shuttle. And while we have sort of a hole in our launch capability, you know, today, we fully expect commercial launch capability to develop rapidly. And we'll be able to rely on our international partners to bring cargo and people up to the space station too. You know, it's interesting, you know, when you think about it in perspective, you know, one of the things that we lost by not having the space shuttle is the ability to bring large pieces of hardware back to Earth. And one of the last things we brought back from the space station in the last shuttle mission was a broken cooling pump used for the cooling system on the space station. And many of us here on the ground can't wait to open that thing up and find out, you know, why it broke. And while we lament that we don't have that what we call down mass capability anymore that the shuttle provided, you know, we also know that we're pretty good at finding workarounds, and we know that in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, we're going to have all kinds of capabilities for launching new stuff and bringing new stuff home. We always seem to find a way to figure out how to do things we need to do. We're not too concerned.
Certainly. And that's the impression that I think a lot of people have, is that the space program, you're in it, you're part of it for a reason, and you know, you figure out solutions to a problem or you know, a challenge, and you overcome it.
Exactly.
That's I guess the thing that I would get from the space program is that's what I think of. Any new developments in the field that you might want to share with the audience? Anything else?
Well, I think there's a couple things. You know, you brought it up in the last question very well, I think. You know, NASA, we're all about trying things that haven't been done before. And every time we go after a new mission, we oftentimes have to develop new technologies. And a lot of times the existing solutions don't always work. And when we try new things, we face setbacks during the development periods. And sometimes those setbacks are, you know, kind of publicized widely as, you know, NASA's making mistakes again. But really, we have setbacks because we stretched and we try to do things that haven't been done before. And ultimately, we come up with solutions, and those solutions wind up being new tools in the toolbox for the future. And many of these tools spin off and out of NASA missions and wind up in other fields. So right now we're doing the Mars Science Laboratory and the James Webb Telescope, and they have really challenging mechanisms that have to operate cold and have to operate hot and have to operate unattended with very low friction and very low wear. And you can look to see all the papers and patents and things like that coming out of our solutions in the coming years and understand that we're pushing technology forward.
So what would you say to those working in the field? What should they take away from today's discussion?
Well, I think one of the things to keep in mind is to try to avoid reinventing the wheel unless you absolutely have to. And what I mean by that is most of the terrestrial tribology problems have been around for a long, long time. And there's a great wealth of information and past experience that has been published and reported on in the STLE literature and in the literature of our you know, companion technical societies. And you know, the trick is to take advantage of what people have done before you rather than spending your time and energy reinventing the wheel. That way you can spend your time and energy pushing the technology forward. And if you do discover a novel solution to a really vexing tribology problem, you know, share it with others. Write a paper, come to an STLE conference and give a presentation, and just try to become more engaged in the tribology community. I know looking back over my career, being more engaged in the tribology community has been good for me and good for NASA, and I think it can be good for everyone else as well.
Definitely. And even beyond publishing papers as well, it's meeting people like yourself. Subject matter experts who have been there, have done that, have done things, you know, address problems like SARGE or, you know, other things like that, that, you know, you're a wealth of knowledge as well, not just
Sure.
papers that have been published. So it's certainly something that you want to tap into. Well, alrighty. Well, thank you so much, Chris, for joining us today and for your insight.
Yep, you are very welcome. It's my pleasure.
I'm Carol Lamar. For more news, information, and research on space tribology, you can visit our website. NASA's website is also a good resource to start from. Thanks for joining us today. This has been another episode of the STLE Compass, pointing you in the right direction.